This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, met last week to vote on new recommendations for vaccines in the United States. The group debated a range of proposals, from requiring prescriptions to get a COVID vaccine to changes for childhood vaccine recommendations. The panel's recommendations are more than just recommendations to the public. American insurance companies determine what they cover based on those recommendations, and the recommendations guide the policy decisions of public entities. Carrie Waller is the director of nursing for the Abilene-Taylor County Public Health District, and she joins us in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
All right. Can you briefly describe how the public health office gets its vaccine and establishes the local immunization policy?
Of course. So we are funded through the Department of State Health Services, and those recommendations typically funnel down through the CDC. Right now, those are still the recommendations that we are currently using, and our immunizations funding was fully funded through the state of Texas through the Department of State Health Services for this year. So that's the Texas Vaccines for Children program. And we are still receiving funding from the state for that program. And so as far as kiddos being able to be vaccinated through our state programs, we still have all of the recommended childhood vaccines available in clinic for those kiddos. Now, there were changes to the recommendations for children and pregnant women to the COVID-19 vaccines, and so we are no longer carrying those in clinic.
That answers the next question I had, which was specifically about the COVID vaccines. A lot of us, myself included, my kid, we went to the convention center during those immunizations that happened. So right now you don't carry the COVID vaccine? Is that what you're saying?
We're not carrying those in clinic right now.
No. Gotcha.
Yeah. But anybody can go right now to the pharmacy. And they're able to access those vaccines either through their insurance or through private pay or through their doctor's offices. We just don't have them as state-funded vaccines through our program right now.
And I know this is maybe not exactly in your purview, but let's say that I'm 35 years old in perfect health and I no longer fall under that recommendation. Is my insurance still going to cover that? Do you know, or does it depend on the insurance company?
That's going to depend on your individual insurance and your plan. And, you know, there is some talk of some insurances may require a doctor's prescription, some won't, but it is going to just depend on your actual insurance company.
Thank you for that information, because I think it is confusing because the goalposts just tend to be moving a little bit on us right now. What about seasonal flu, RSV? Can I get my immunizations there?
Yes, we have both private immunizations that we can offer with private insurance, and then we also have state-funded vaccines that are through, of course, the Texas Immunizations Program, and so those are for children with Medicaid or that are uninsured, and then we also have an awesome program for adults that are uninsured. And that's called charity care. So it can be either free or at a reduced cost for you. So we want to keep people as healthy as possible. We just want people to have the access that they need. And so whatever you choose, we have that available. We have a wide variety of things available. Like I said, the only thing we don't have available right now is the COVID-19 vaccine. If you're wanting to get something that's off schedule, you do need a prescription from your doctor. But if it's something that's a normal vaccine that's on schedule for you, either as an adult or a child, you can come and get those at the health department from us.
We know that, and it's over now, but for a short time, there was an epidemic with the measles in far west Texas. And some people were saying that if you were concerned about not having the right boosters, or if you didn't know for sure if you had the boosters as a kid, you could come and get. Do they need a prescription to get that measles booster? Or is that something that they can just show up and get?
So there's certain criteria that we look at as far as whether you had one booster or two as a child, what year you were born, those types of things. So we'll evaluate you. If you do need a prescription from your doctor, we'll let you know. But there's also blood titers that we can run. And those blood titers will tell us whether or not you've mounted immunity. And so that's really helpful. We want to look at the evidence and the data before we just are giving unnecessary vaccines.
ACIP also discussed the vaccination schedule for children. Ultimately, they postponed a vote to change the recommendations for hepatitis B, the shot traditionally administered before a newborn leaves the hospital. The proposal they were going to consider was to delay it by a month or longer. Did they vote against recommending a combined measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox vaccine in young children? And I know that those kind of goalposts have been moving recently.
As far as I know, it hasn't been changed yet. We have not received guidance for that as of yet. If the guidance changes, as far as we're concerned, you know, we are required as a public department, as a government entity, to follow said guidance. Now, that being said, AAP will also release guidance, and that's always... American Academy of Pediatrics is also releasing guidance based on things that they've looked at. And if you feel more comfortable with a different vaccine that a manufacturer is offering as far as a combo vaccine, or if you want to give those separately, you can always talk with your individual pediatrician and make those decisions separately for your child.
Thank you for the clarity in unclear times. We really appreciate it. You know, when things change, it's hard to keep up. And I know you guys have got a lot of work to keep up with changes in policies, too. Thank you, Carrie Waller, the Director of Nursing for the Abilene-Taylor County Public Health District. Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Can I just say one thing?
Absolutely.
It's National Night Out. It's going to be October 7th. Mm-hmm. That's on the APD grounds over on South First. We are going to have free flu shots that night. So stop by the public health table if you want to get a free flu shot, and we're happy to take care of you there.
Flu shot and bouncy houses. It all goes together.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. ACIP recommendations aren't final until they've been reviewed and approved by the CDC director. CDC directors have almost always accepted the recommendations, though some directors who did not agree with them have resigned or been fired. In the West Texas cotton fields and pecan groves near the border lie the remains of buildings that mark an important moment in U.S. history that you may not know about. They served as a recruiting center where men from Mexico arrived during World War II and the Korean War to fill critical labor shortages. Most harvested crops, some worked for the railroads. They were called braceros, or strong arms, and a new national historical landmark now recognizes their contributions. KTEP's Angela Kucherga reports.
It was a hidden history amid cotton fields just off a roadway that cuts through the small border city of Socorro. Victor Retta is the historic preservation officer for the city. As we walk through a large courtyard, he points out the deteriorating structures, including a dining hall, temporary sleeping quarters, and chapel.
We do have over 20 mixed material buildings. Some of them are adobe, some of them are wood, some of them are metal. Either way, they're each significant and they're each important.
Important because the buildings hold the memories of tens of thousands of men from Mexico who came to work so American men could go off to war. Created by an agreement between the U.S. and Mexico, the Bracero program provided critical labor for America between 1942 and 1964. Nearly 5 million men took part overall.
Ay, qué triste es la vida, qué triste vida es la del bracero.
Mexican singer Pedro Infante recounts the hope and hard life the strong-armed braceros faced when they made the journey north to the U.S. Their first stop was one of five reception centers on the border. The main one was here in Socorro, where the desperately needed workers got a warm welcome, says Cela Monte Casper, director of the nonprofit Latinos in Heritage Conservation.
There were two flags that were standing there side by side, one American flag and one Mexican flag. And there was a big sign that said Bienvenidos, and they had mariachis playing for them.
But historians say the men also went through a degrading health screening process. Monte Casper says they were sprayed with chemicals, including the now banned insecticide DDT.
They would get in, they would be deloused, they would be stripped down naked. Their hands would be checked to see, you know, how many calluses they had. Their muscles would be checked to see if they were strong.
Pues yo fui de los últimos que pasé en ese tiempo.
81-year-old Jose Rodriguez is part of the last generation of braceros to come through this site in 1964.
Piscar el melón, levantarlo.
I remember the hard work picking melons and carrying the cantaloupes in a sack slung over my shoulder.
I met Rodriguez at the Senior Citizen Center run by the City of Socorro, housed in one of the restored buildings at the historic site. Fundraising is underway to build a bracero museum and cultural center. Rodriguez is glad the history of the bracero is finally being recognized.
It would be beautiful to remember again that time when we were protagonists. I am a bracero.
This location, known as Rio Vista, was the first permanent bracero site and the last still standing. Less than 1% of the places listed in the National Historic Register are associated with Latino history or heritage. Socorro's Historic Preservation Officer, Victor Retta.
We are an NHL. We're a National Historic Landmark, you know, for the same significance as the Alamo or Ellis Island. So we're so incredibly grateful that not only our community sees the importance of that, but also people at the national level.
And in this region, often known as the Ellis Island of the Southwest, the landmark is also significant for countless families across the country, descendants of the braceros, who trace their American story to this spot. I'm Angela Cocherga in Socorro.
You're listening to the West Texas Dispatch. Like many small Texas cities, Abilene was built on the railroad, and its legacy still runs through the heart of the city. This week, Alexis Jones takes a look back at the history of the rail system in Abilene and how a new festival is keeping that story alive. The Railroad Festival just wrapped up its second year, and it's quickly becoming a local favorite. Here's KACU's Alexis Jones with more.
Back in 1881, the Texas Pacific Railway was laying tracks westward. As ranchers and businessmen were searching for a central shipping point for cattle and goods, they zeroed in on a spot in the open prairie, just east of Buffalo Gap. According to Coriander Taylor, director of the Abilene Railroad Fest, that choice gave birth to the city of Abilene.
You know, majority of these communities around Abilene wouldn't be here unless, you know, if the railroad hadn't come through.
From the start, the railroad defined life in Abilene. Cattle, cotton, grain, and later oil moved through the rail yards. The TMP Depot became a hub of activity, not just for freight, but for passengers. Families waved goodbye to loved ones, soldiers departed for war, and visitors from across the country arrived by train.
And our last passenger train, I believe, came through in 1967, and we haven't had passenger service since. So we are strictly a freight line. We have two locals, one between Fort Worth and Abilene, and then one between here and Big Spring, and those tend to service all of the little small industries in between.
Today, the freight trains still rumble through Abilene, carrying the raw materials and goods that keep the Texas economy moving. But the golden age of the passenger rail exists mostly in memory, and in historical landmarks like the restored TNP Depot downtown. Organizers, alongside local historical groups, revived the Abilene Railroad Fest last year. And Taylor says it's a great opportunity to shine a spotlight on the city's railroading roots.
So the Abilene Railroad Festival is actually from the 90s. It started in 1991 and ran through 1997. But obviously it didn't really take off. So it ended up petering out. So I eventually became a staff member and took on the Abilene Railroad Festival. So last year we opted to give it a try and see how it went, and it went well. So here we are again.
Abigail Payne, the executive director for the Abilene Preservation League, says the festival is designed to be both educational and entertaining.
Living history and exhibits, presentations. We had a choo-choo train that carried adults and children, like a trackless train. We had people checking in at the TMP Depot, just as you know, if you had gotten off of a train in 1890. It's an event that is for families and train enthusiasts, so we try to cater to whether you have a four-year-old that likes Thomas the Train, or if you're a senior citizen that has researched and followed trains your whole life.
Organizers say the festival also helps people see trains and Abilene's history in a new light.
Prior to being in this position, if I was stopped at a railway crossing, it was just an annoyance. But now, after learning more about the railroad, I'm thinking this is a picture of commerce and transportation, bringing, you know, refrigerated foods or just all sorts of things that we need in our daily life.
Payne says even the work to organize the event helps lay new tracks, connecting different parts of the community.
Being in a smaller community, collaborating together means that we all get to succeed and share in the joy of bringing an event and entertainment to Abilene. And the more people, the more organizations you can have involved in that, I think the more exciting it is, the healthier it is.
The history, train-themed activities, music, and food all add to the main goal. Fun.
One of my main goals was to create less of a convention or exhibition experience and make it truly feel like a festival. I was joking with the staff that I wanted to party like it was 1881.
From the early days of cattle cars to today with the annual Railroad Fest, the Abilene Railroad serves as a point of connection for the Abilene community. I'm Alexis Jones in Abilene.
Community members in a small town outside of Lubbock are ready to see the reopening of a historic movie theater that's been closed for 40 years. This project has been years in the making and united generations of people from Hockley County to bring back a place of education and tourism on the South Plains. KTTZ's Brad Burt reports.
For many in Loveland, Texas, about 25 miles west of Lubbock, the Wallace Theater has been a closed building on the downtown corner of Houston Street, across from the Hockley County Courthouse. The theater, first opened in 1928 by Wallace Blankenship as part of what would become the largest chain of small-town movie theaters in the U.S., it closed in the 1980s, but many still hold memories that they want future West Texans to share. George Keeling purchased the theater in 2002 with the plan to restore it. He passed away in 2016, but his daughter, Allison Keeling, was already behind seeing her father's goal to the end.
To look back at that, where we started to where we are today, it truly is remarkable. And it's all because of the community support and that people have jumped on board, they're donating their time, you know, they're making it happen.
The years of work on this restoration have not always been easy. The theater has seen some damage and dust buildup, and the auditorium's old seats were past saving, but Keeling says she was on a mission. Teaming up with sound technology professor Dolph Guardiola from Loveland South Plains College, Keeling says they got parts of the theater in a state that could host events to bring attention and funding toward the work to be done at the Wallace.
We got the lobby into a shape where we could actually bring people in. It still had holes in the ceiling and it still had the water damage on the walls, but it had this magic to it, right? When you walked in, it was so special.
Keeling's team worked from old photos and records to bring back as much as they could from the Wallace's original style. After cleanup days with members of the community, new murals in the auditorium were painted to match the originals, with the ceiling's floral design hand-painted by historic paint restoration specialists. She tracked down pieces of the old carpet from classic car collectors and found some in corners of the building to inspire new looks.
We found this other piece of carpet, and it matched another photo that I had that was from the Wallace in the 1920s, and it was the carpet from the 1920s. It's more of a floral pattern, so that's the wallpaper in the women's restroom.
Some elements of the theater's design will be new, like the film reel chandelier in the lobby, the open dance floor in the auditorium, and the technology in the auditorium for movies, concerts, and theatrical productions. But Keeling said all of it comes from a love for the history of Hockley County and support of the Loveland community. Loveland has been called the City of Mosaics, and many famous musicians have graduated from South Plains College's well-known commercial music program. So Keeling feels like this restoration is an important step in preserving the city's arts culture. But some of these new updates and partnerships with Hockley County Schools are designed to give the Wallace an educational value as much as entertainment.
Studies have shown that utilizing the arts helps with students' retention, helps improve test scores, graduation rates, school attendance. And so if we can support in that way, then that's how we can make a difference for students in Hockley County.
Board member Dylan Palmer Webb went to high school with Keeling and Leveland and came to the project 2 years ago, and he said it was the educational potential that really brought him in.
My family's been in Leveland for 100 years as of last year, so always heard stories, and it's always been in a positive light. And once I figured out that the Wallace was also going to be instrumental in educating over 4,000 kids in the area, that was kind of the linchpin for me.
Webb said he's hoping the work that has gone into this restoration will ripple out and inspire others to take pride in their small towns. He's now working to establish an endowment that would make sure the work of Keeling's team will last for future generations.
Sometimes these theaters will go through a huge renovation. They'll get rocking and rolling, and they'll be doing well for several years. And then for whatever reason, activity falls off, revenue falls off, and they may be in a situation where they can't pay the bills that they're still paying for in the renovation, or they just can't stay open. So an endowment would protect that.
For Libby Tubb Thetford, whose family was among the first in Hockley County more than 100 years ago, this theater holds a special place in her childhood.
Well, I came to this beautiful Wallace Theater when I was a little girl, and I love watching what they're doing, and it's real special to me and my family, the Tubb family, so that's why I'm here, to help out, because they have done a beautiful job.
Thetford has educated thousands of children in Hockley County, including Allison Keeling. She's proud of the work between longtime family friends and community members and what this means for the history and the future of Leveland and Hockley County.
I mean, it's just, they've moved mountains, you know, over the years, and we're so excited that it just brings tears to my eyes.
I'm Brad Burt in Lubbock.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. Every fall, West Texans look to the skies for one of nature's most remarkable journeys, the migration of the monarch. Traveling thousands of miles from Canada to Mexico, monarch butterflies pass right through the big country, making our region an important stopover along the way. Their numbers have been declining, though, in recent years, and conservationists say the butterflies face growing challenges from habitat loss and even climate change. Today, we're talking with Jean Dotson. She is with the Big Country Naturalists, about the monarch's migration, the role that our local environment plays in the journey, and how communities here in West Texas can help make sure this iconic species continues to thrive. Jean, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
How big a fan are you of monarch butterflies?
Huge. I've been studying them since 2008, and they're just amazing. I find out new things all the time. So,
talk to me about the migration. What is this migration, and why do they travel so far?
They live as far as Canada, and so some butterflies actually leave Canada and fly all the way to Mexico. There's a question about whether or not they mate along the way. There's years and years ago, a scientist said that there was a sexual dipause. They do not mate. But in West Texas, we find eggs all the time in the fall, so they are actually mating on their way down. They go to Mexico because the winters up north start to deplete the milkweed supply and the nectar supply, so they start moving south. And initially, I thought they go there because it's warm, but actually they go to the mountains of Michoacán where it's actually very cold. They live in oil-mill fir trees down there, and the fir trees are like an insulation. The branches are very thick, and they insulate the butterflies and keep them warm. One of the problems in Mexico with the migration is that there's illegal logging going on, and they've made monarch sanctuaries, but still people cut down those oil-mill trees, which then leave the monarchs exposed to the elements. So there's a little problem there, but...
Sure. Well, they're traveling Mexico, Canada. They obviously are coming through the big country. What's important about us specifically in this,
okay,
in this chain?
One thing about the migration, coming north in the spring, They come from Mexico. They lay eggs and die in Texas. And then their offspring mate, lay eggs, and they keep traveling north as far as Canada. So those butterflies live 3 to 4 weeks. The winter butterflies live up to 8 months. And so they can go all the way from Canada to Mexico, spend the whole winter, and then come back north again. We are important. We are a huge part of the migration pathway. And I think some of the reasons for some misconceptions is that West Texas wasn't a part of the research. We are right in the middle of it.
Sure.
And so one thing that's really neat about ACU is that I have a friend who taught here in the 70s. And in the 70s, there were the trees were completely full of monarchs at night in October. And so the monarchs from Canada go to the exact same trees that their great-great-grandparents left a year before. They've never been there, and yet they end up in the same exact trees. My hypothesis is that the ones that are coming here are descendants of the ones who passed here a year ago. So,
wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. What is that peak time for West Texas? And that time has changed a little bit, hasn't it?
It's usually around October 5th that you see giant roosts here. Now, when it's around Labor Day, we see some individual monarchs coming and laying eggs. So those seem to come about a month before. Mm-hmm. It takes about a month to go from the egg to butterfly. And so the peak is around October 5th. You can study Journey North maps. People across the country post when they see a roost, and so you can watch the migration coming down. I looked last night. It looks like Nebraska is about where they are right now. So,
internet. You can follow it all nowadays. Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
Even the butterflies are on the internet. What are some of the biggest threats facing that population today?
In the U.S., the threats are habitat loss. I live off of Antley, and my little microcosm, Hospital Drive, was a huge milkweed patch.
Yeah.
And every year, two or three office buildings are built, and that's cleared. And so I actually post sightings on iNaturalist, and so now there are my little green dots on parking lots on the map, when you look at the map now. So habitat loss is big. Poison, mm-hmm. Farmers using Roundup Ready. They use Roundup Ready corn and cotton, I believe, and so they can spray Roundup right on the crops. It used to be that milkweed grew in between all the crops. Now it kills everything but the cotton or the wheat, and so that's increased loss of habitat.
Well, you know, it's a really good point because, you know, these monarchs have been doing this for probably millions or hundreds of thousands of years, and you know, they're still doing their thing,
right.
But the topography has changed, at least what's growing out
yes.
there. Because you look at what natural grasses are in Texas, and there's not a lot of it left.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about what role we can do. So we people, there's things that we can do to help with them with their habitat, right?
Yes. So having nectar plants in the fall, also leaving milkweed, asking the mowers at TxDOT and other places not to mow at the beginning of September when they're coming through would be a big thing. Planting milkweed, native milkweed is best to plant mm-hmm. So that they have places to lay eggs. And
how would I do that? Let's say, I've got a nice little garden bed in the back and I've got space for it. How do I do that?
So Native American Seed sells some native monarchs, native milkweed seed, sorry. Mm-hmm. And you could order it there. You could call me and I'd give you some seeds. Collect seeds in the fall and then cast them in your yard and places where it's not going to be developed, I guess.
And not mowed at
not
that
mowed,
moment.
Yeah.
There you go. I like it. Where it isn't developed, too. That's a good idea. Are there some upcoming events that citizens around here can get involved with?
Around October 1st, usually the 5th, is when I see giant roosts around ACU.
Yeah.
So starting to look at the beginning of October and looking just in the trees. If you stop and you look at the trees, I've gone with my husband. I say, there aren't any here. And then in just a minute, you see one open its wings and flap, and you see that bright orange. And then you realize the trees are completely covered, but they're hanging in such a way that they're not visible.
Yeah.
And so they look like leaves.
So ACU is a good place to come.
It's a great place.
So is the zoo, right? I mean,
yes,
they have
yes.
specifically planted milkweed and made it a hospitable place.
Right.
Any other places you can think of in the area that are good monarch watching areas?
I know some private places. I think the Abilene State Park also has some monarch roosts.
I'm sure they do. That just seems like something the state park would do. Jean, thank you for joining us today.
We really appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.
And happy monarch watching as we get closer and closer to that peak in about 2 weeks. As monarchs continue their journey through the big country, their survival depends in part on the choices we make at our home, reminding us we can even take small steps, like she said, planting milkweed or protecting open spaces. It's time for West Texas Roots. This past Monday marked the fall equinox, the moment when day and night are equal in length, signaling the change of seasons. For many cultures, including indigenous communities here in Texas, the equinox carries deep meanings tied to the cycles of the earth, harvest, and renewal. In today's segment, Guy Narcomi joins us to share the history and legend behind the fall equinox and the importance it held for his ancestors.
We know that the earth monster or changing woman, that before before she became changing woman, she was a cocoon, giving life through metamorphosis, right? And in metamorphosis, in two or three stages of metamorphosis, you can be two things at the same time. But then after she hardened and became this Mother Earth, she gave birth to two twins, right? And the sun and the moon. We say it's the sun and the moon. Okay, other people may say something else. Other tribes, other peoples. And then, so then after she became the sun and the moon, sometimes I get it confused in my head, but she became the reason why I believe she was called the Earth Monster was because she brought hurricanes and fires and tornadoes and, you know, fire ants and dangerous things, you know, rattlesnakes, you know, that's part of her. All of that comes from this earth, the resource. Mother Earth is a resource for all living things, right? So, so then every 19 years, in a very straight line, the sun is born at the Buttes in San Angelo wet morning, and the following evening, the moon is born directly across from this where the sun, near Gatesville, Texas. So both the twins are born. So it's on that. It happens only every 19 years. So she dies giving birth to the two. And she has to, and when does that happen? In the fall, when everything begins to change color and lose its leaves. And well, she's dead, the poor thing. But look at what we have now. Probably the most important thing to our people is time. Right? The sun and its movement. The moon and its movement. You know, and you could say the moon is telling time by the seconds. The sun is telling time by the hour. And then the moon could be telling time as the months. The constellations could be telling time as the years go by, as the years go by, and the centuries and the millennia. Then you've got the procession of the equinox. Once again, the same problem. No one's ever done a real study on indigenous people and their reactions or behaviors to annular eclipses. But I'll tell you what, when I look into the Spanish records, about the entradas, you know, when the Spanish were coming in, they'll talk about events when we would gather. They'll talk about events when we would war with each other, especially. They talk about events through the 16th and 17th centuries, 18th centuries. But they'll never write why we were gathering. They'll never write what was going on in the skies. They'll never do it. I'm like, why leave that out? So they don't want you to know. They don't want us to look back into the past and say, well, our ancestors used to gather over here like that. And they gathered over here like that because something in the sky was happening. Well, every place, every time that I even used Eric's work. Every time that I went back into Eric's part of the paper and looked for when there were gatherings, you could never find why they were gathering. They just said that they were hanging out. So if you'd use Starry Nights and you go back into time, you look at the skies and you know what you're looking for. Oh, it was an annular eclipse. Or in the case of the Virgin of Guadalupe, it was Halley's Comet. But nobody says anything. What's the deal? They don't want you to remember.
We recorded Guy's story at Paint Rock. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Ballet Folclorico de Álvaro Muñoz has been sharing the beauty and richness of Mexican culture through dance for more than six decades. This year, the award-winning company is celebrating their 62nd anniversary of Alegría Mexicana, a vibrant performance that highlights traditional dances from across Mexico, from Hidalgo and Yucatan to Jalisco and Sinaloa. The show will also feature guest artists from Texas, California, and beyond. KACU's Alexis Jones sat down with Álvaro Muñoz to talk about the upcoming performance at the Paramount Theater in Abilene, the mission behind Ballet Folklorico, and what audiences can expect from this colorful celebration.
For more than six decades, the Alegría Mexicana has celebrated Mexican history and culture through dance, carrying traditions from Veracruz to Jalisco and beyond. I sat down with the executive director and choreographer, Álvaro Muñoz. Álvaro, thank you so much for being here. If you just want to explain the history, like 62 years, right, of Alegría Mexicana.
Yes, we are celebrating our 62nd anniversary. The group was established in 1963 by my aunt, and she had it for a few years and then got married, of course, went to Mexico City. So the group was left under the direction of Miss Cristina Monreal. Then from there, I mean, since then, the group has, you know, has gone through several directors. I came back in 2019 to take over the group. And that's where we're at. We're celebrating our 62nd anniversary. This year's theme for our show is Alegría Mexicana, which, you know, the music from Mexico is always alegre, very happy, very fast-paced movement. And it shows the joys of the bright, colorful, how vibrant the culture of Mexico is. We have dancers from Dallas. As a matter of fact, I have three that take classes from me that travel from Dallas to Abilene. We also branched out to Midland. We branched out back in April of this year, and we have 20 dancers from that are part of our group here locally in Abilene.
That's amazing. So you have a long history of like collaboration with people from different communities. What do these partnerships kind of mean to you?
I think it's very important to bring the community together. For me, it's very personal. I take great pride in our culture. And for me to show, which a lot of our young generation this year, our young generation has really lost their history, especially our Hispanic children. They lose sight of where they come from. And I think it's very important to teach my students, for example, the history of Mexico, through the art of dance.
Why is that so important to you? What really lit that spark?
I think for me, it was more my grandparents. My grandparents came as immigrants to the United States, and for them, it was really important for them to teach us our culture. What better way to teach that through the art of dance? Because that's how I was taught, and that's how I learned to appreciate our cultural background.
Yeah. So, do you think it's even more important right now for you to teach this and to showcase it in the community?
Yes, that's really important to me. That shows the struggles of the history of how Mexico has evolved. We are presenting dances because Mexico offers a lot of, that comes from a lot of different backgrounds. It's not just true Mexicans that originated there. You know, we have Spaniard, we have French that have migrated there. So all those different types of cultures is what makes the Mexican folklorico.
Yeah, and the event this Saturday specifically kind of takes the audience on a journey through the different regions. So how did you choose, like, dances, what dances to highlight?
Every year I try to keep the program fresh and new. Of course, we got to keep some of the traditional dances that do go with every show, like the Mexican hat dance, which is considered the national dance of the country of Mexico. But we decided to give it a fresh new look. That way, you know, people are not like, oh, it's the same show every year. So I do my research. I see what the kids like, what captivates them. And I've come to notice that the kids like, they're very fast paced with a lot of the, what we call zapateado, which is kind of like tap, but they like the high energy dances. So I go through there and I try to see what catches my eye, what catches the dancer's eyes, and then we go from there.
Do you have a favorite dance or region that's represented in this event?
I love Sinaloa Costa. That's one of my favorite regions, which is actually something new that we are doing this year. Usually we close with the traditional from the region of Jalisco, which is considered the Mexican hat dance. But this year I decided to do, we brought in a teacher from Sinaloa in Mexico, and he taught us Sinaloa Costa. And it's a combination, kind of hard to explain. It's a combination of Las Vegas showgirl, tropical, cumbia, salsa, and Mexican folkloric all fused together all at once.
Okay.
So it's a very high energy, high fast pace, something that we're going to close with this year. I think the audience is going to really enjoy it. They're going to get there. We're going to bring them to their feet. It gives you more of a Caribbean type feel with folkloric mixed into it.
My last question that I had is, for anyone who's still needing to get their tickets, where do they go?
Look us up on social media, on Facebook or on TikTok and Instagram. We do have a link there, or that they can purchase their tickets, or they can go to go on the Paramount Theater website and click on events and go click on it. I believe if you go to the calendar for the 27th, just click on there and you'll find the link there, or they can purchase them at the door.
Thanks again. The Allegro Mexicana will be performed by Ballet Folclorico de Alvaro Muñoz at the Paramount Theater in downtown Abilene. It's a celebration of heritage, history, and the joy of dance. I'm Alexis Jones in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. We hope you join us and tell all your friends. And if your friends can't tune in Wednesdays at noon, that's okay. They can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Just type in West Texas Dispatch. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our producers, Heather Claiborne and Alexis Jones. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.